once every 2 or 3 years by the Forest Service. The Heart Lake Trail was in pretty good shape most of the time. But going up to Holden Lake, you got scratched up a bit. There's only one section of the trail up there right now that approximates the way it was most of the way up. And it was steep. The switchbacks that were put in were not there. There was one switchback. The trail through the woods up there has been changed, but you can see the old blaze marks, approximately 4 inches deep into the tree that were on there in the early 40s. As far as the history, the physical layout of the plant, and the background is concerned, I recommend to you this book by Dr. Edmond that's available in the Hike House called The Mine. I read this over, and from my recollection, this is a tremendously accurate account of the history and the workings of the mine, and a summary figures as far as the geology and the production and so forth are concerned, which includes the entire production up to 1957. I can't give you any breakdown as to figures, because these were of no concern to me. I can tell you about how this mine operated. The people, the men who were here, all worked at the mine. This was the common background. Everybody here was productive. We had one man who lost his eyesight in an accident outside in the mine, at the mine works. And this man was retrained and was operated this company commissary. And I'll tell you about some of the facilities here in a little bit. He was productive for the company. Everybody here was, except for one. And how they got in here, it was a thorn in the side of the company. Lot one, right where that rock wall stands up there in the upper campsite, was a retired couple from Chelan, name of G.W. Polk. No relationship to the mine whatsoever. I can't remember who they bought from. They bought from somebody who had built this place up, and they moved up here. In no way were they concerned with the company. And feelings that I had heard at the time was that the company didn't like it. But somehow they seemed to be powerless to do anything about it. Now, the people were retired, as I say, so they really didn't cause any trouble. To me, they seemed like an odd couple. Kind of eccentric people. And I just talked to a nurse at Chelan just the other night who was up here, who knows many of the people from Holden in these early days and the later ones too, and she said, yes, he was pretty much eccentric, all right. I inquired about them. Apparently they both have died now. I wouldn't venture to speak on it. I don't know. I don't recall that she had any cats at the time, but she might have. Pets didn't seem to be much in abundance up here. I don't recall much. We didn't have a pet. I liked to have a pet, but my folks always said that it wasn't too easy to raise a pet up here or something like that, which I think is probably erroneous now. But I don't recall too many pets around. Now, she may have. And again, she may have collected cats later on after I left, too. As you can tell, there are mice around here. Cats could be helpful. Yeah. Also pointed out, we built our own houses. Now, we had a company-oriented reason for being here. We also had a pride in the community because part of ourselves were here. I mean, if you've worked all the sweat and hard work of digging out a basement that there is, even on a mountainside, you leave part of yourself here. It's kind of a sore spot in your heart, I suppose, when you know it's all torn down after all the work you went to. We were building for most of the time we were here. Our rock walls would have stood for a long, long time. My father is quite a construction man. But the bulldozer took him down. He broke both wrists of his arm, his hands, falling off the scaffolding when we were building the porch roof. He fell down in the rock pile underneath. The company put him to work, first of all, cleaning up the upstairs of the office. He went through the records from 1937 to, 43, I think he had this accident. sorting out, throwing away the things that were no longer of value. He brought some of them home, so we used them for scratch paper. Sorry to say I don't have any of them. And I really don't know what they said. Then after that, they put him to work on the tailings dump with these big yellow piles out here. Number one at that time. The first one that's been cut back, not the little piece that's down here by the power plant, but the one that's higher up. It's been cut out somewhat. That's where he started. This is the tailings dump that was being built at this time. He worked there tending gates and so forth, and then until he could go back in the mine again. A few of the things that might be interesting about this commissary down here, the Hike House right now. It was originally laid out that from where the present post office is situated, a counter ran parallel to the front wall, approximately back to where the wall of the Hike House itself starts. A door was through there, going back into a storage room, just downstream, because that's the southeast, isn't it? From the present big wide door, the door went through there into a storage room. The post office, United States Post Office, Holden, Washington Station, regular postmaster, was situated right where the Hike House is now, that is up to and allowing a passageway between the commissary area back. It was probably only about 10 feet deep at first. And we had a row of boxes across the same way as the Hike House counter faces, about 150 boxes perhaps. In approximately 46, this was remodeled to double the size of the post office, and another set of boxes was set in around the corner going toward the back. The commissary itself was in use the entire time I was here. There were no other stores until 1946. We bought our groceries in Chelan, or a few odds and ends of things at the commissary. They did stock some foods like candy bars and things of this nature. But candy bars were in short supply during the Second World War, so we didn't really see much of this. I recall in 1946, when we did get a grocery store in here, that one of the first things I wanted to do was get some candy bars, some chocolate, because we didn't have them, and that is nationally. This isn't peculiar to Holden. So this commissary was sort of the country store, you might say. It was company run, and we used company money here. The company minted tin money, as we called it. Now, I'm not sure of the composition of it. My wife tells me it wasn't tin, can't be tin, it's too scarce. But I'm not so sure about that. I really don't know what it is. But we had tin money. It was in the form of 10-cent pieces, 25-cent, and 50-cent. Notice I'm careful not to call them by the U.S. money. We were also careful not to call them that. They said on them, redeemable in trade, Howsam Mining Company. The men got this money by drawing on their paychecks. And we used it as legal tender at the commissary. And in the recreation hall, the men used it for paying for the pool tables and playing poker. In other words, it's sort of like poker chips. At the U.S. Post Office, of course, we had to use Uncle Sam's money. We also used Uncle Sam's pennies and Washington State's little zinc and plastic sales tax tokens, which if you're from Washington, you know back in the 40s, we had sales tax tokens worth 1/3 of 1 cent, I think it was. It was the rate at the time. Sales tax tokens went out about 46 or 47. First ones had a little hole in the center. You could string them like beads. Then in 1943, metal ran out, so they painted them out of green plastic. We used them up here. Played tiddlywinks with them. We had to charge, the company had to charge sales tax, I believe, and we had to use them at the commissary. In 1946, Price Grocery Store of Chelan, Washington, was allowed to bring a store in here, and the first floor of dormitory or lodge 6, we called these dormitories, and the signs were dorm, where you have lodge, over lodge 2, that's the original sign. You can see underneath it dorm. where they've changed it to large. So these are the same numbers. The Price grocery store came into dorm 6, first floor. I think they still use the upstairs for men to room in. The back part of it was used for storage for the store. This, of course, was a dormitory. It was not hollowed out like this at the time. That was 46. At the same time, they enlarged the post office. At the same time, they built a little stairway on the side of the hike house there. You can see, if you look up, the eaves are spliced. This was put in a little better traveling up and down there. I believe also about this time they put a little piece of concrete in at the basement of the recreation hall, or at the recreation hall steps by the fountain lunch down there. I think that was put in at that time. We had a doctor up here who was very, very heavy. Must have weighed about 300 or 350 pounds. He came down those steps, slipped at the bottom, and broke his leg just in all directions. Shortly thereafter, they put the concrete walk in, which I presume would help him. I believe that was true. Remember that the schoolhouse now was a two-room schoolhouse. We had two teachers. I do not remember the names of the first, second, third, and fourth grade, which was in the first room, which is now the one over the top of the ceramic shop. For the first two years I was here, it was four grades in that room. Then it went to three grades. The teachers changed in that room. But the other room, which was fifth through eighth when I started in it, and when my sister, who was 2 years behind me, started, she went fourth grade in there. Four through eight. I went through five through eight in that one room, moving over toward the window in the playground. This is the one. This is the way it was. We started by the blackboards where the cupboards are now and moved over to the window. I was always at the back, of course, and I was sitting right by that doorway in my last year looking out the window all year long. Mrs. Florence Field was the teacher. She is now teaching in Chelan. She taught here the entire life of this camp in that capacity as principal and teacher of the upper four or five grades. In 1948-9, winter, they built the basement. 1948, I think it was. They put the basement in where the ceramic shop is and moved a grade or two down there. In 1949, I believe, they put the addition on the side of the school, the one out into the playground. I do not know how they divided up the grades. When I came back in 1949 for the 1 week, I did see this construction underway. Saw how it was going to be. Mrs. Field was, you might say, the town disciplinarian if there was any discipline necessary for the children. We did not have stealing. We did not have child problems here. Of course, we didn't have teenagers, which a lot of people say that's the cause of most of the trouble outside the outside world now with children, but we didn't have anything small like that. If anything came up, and the parents couldn't necessarily cope with it, Mrs. Field, as principal of the school, usually found a way. I remember I threw a snowball coming to school one time, broke a pair of glasses on somebody. I spent a day in that library, which is the back room in this corner out toward the street, was the library, a little tiny room. I was disciplined for throwing snowballs. Other little things like this, certain rules that we had. We did not have automobiles up here. Automobiles were forbidden. For safety reasons, I suppose, as much as anything else. The company hauled its concentrates out of here on these trucks, three barrels to a truck. They had great big horns, about so long, on the cabs, on the top. And when they got to the top of that hill down there, they'd stop, and they'd blow that horn. You could hear it all the way down. And they'd wait. They got no answer. I presume, they would proceed on down. In other words, when that ore truck was going down, nobody else was to be on that hill. In the 6 years that I know directly, two trucks went over that hill. One of them lost its brakes and went off one of the switchbacks and went down to the creek bottom. The driver, fortunately, escaped. He got out as it went over the edge. The truck was completely demolished, of course. Another one parked too close to the edge, and the bank gave way, and the truck tipped over. They salvaged that truck. Those are the only two accidents that I know of on that road. 1947, I think, they began to allow private cars up here, which I would imagine would change some things about how the people behaved and their outlook and so forth. Because when I was here, we walked. That's the only way you had to get around. We had a daily bus, exactly as it is here now. Except it seems like they're running 4 or 5 buses up here. The Lucerne Bus Company, operating out of Lucerne, met the boat as it came in. Same boats, same schedule. Picked the people up at the Holden Dock and brought them up here. I think he first stopped at Lucerne Dock, picked up people that got off there, and then moved to the Holden Dock, picked up the people. We loaded our baggage on the top. There was a rack around the top, all goods. Baggage, personal things, mail, so forth, were brought in that way. And hauled it up here. They had about a half an hour up here to unload, put on and load again. And then they went back down to meet the boat coming back from Stehekin. The boat did not stop at Holden and stay there like it does now. They only ran one boat at a time, usually, and it's mostly for tourists. Remember, the tourist facilities on that lake were there sometime before the mine. It's Stehekin. It was a tourist resort. This place was not advertised as a tourist resort, and tourism was discouraged. They did not have a place for them. They had only places for the men who worked here. I might also bring about out the fact that there were two kinds of people, the family people with their families and the men who were living in these dormitories without their families. Now, the men chose to live without their families for one of two reasons. Either they were not married or they couldn't get a housing site to move their family into. There was a waiting list. As a house became vacant, one of the men down here in the dormitory had spoken for it, and then he'd bring his family up and they'd move in. So this is sort of the migration. The more stable people, and the reason I remember this is I delivered papers for 3 years, so I knew who was moving in and out. My customer route list didn't change very much in dorms 2 and 3. They seemed to move people up there, or they somehow got there, that were here for a long period of time. Dorm 1 was fairly stable. 5 and 6 were, you might say, the transient. They didn't stick around long. The only person who ever beat me out of any money on the paper route was one out of this place, sitting right over there where that blackboard is, approximately. Mm-hmm. I never forget the one that beat me out of about $2. I don't know how he got out, because I unloaded that bus every single day. I met the bus and I unloaded the top of it. That's how I got my paper. But while I was at it, I threw everything else off too, to the bus driver. The bus driver had to stand up on top of the bus and unload through the gate. Which the only thing different about that gate now is the metal pin is missing that was now tied with rope. Engines are the same and everything. We'd unload this and then I helped him load it back up again. So I knew everybody that was going in and out of here. There wasn't any other way out. Later on, and I think it was probably late 1947 when this fellow got away on me, they did begin to run a taxi service up here from Lucerne, much the way it is now. There is an independent taxi, I haven't seen him yet, but comes up, and I think it's the same outfit that was running it at that time. Okay, we didn't have outside people, and we were all here for one purpose. Now, I bring out that this is the difference between Holden as it is today and Holden as it is there then. We were a typical mining community. I wouldn't say uneducated people, but not highly educated people. Those of us in the families, a few had college education, very few. My parents happened to have college education, and as such were in the union. As my father was a union man, he was always called upon to do things for the union, being somewhat educated, more so than most. There were some people here with only 8th grade education. The average, I suppose, was a high school education. The interest was one of work in the mine, shift work. They worked around the clock. Approximately 50% of the people worked day shift, and maybe 25% worked each of the other two shifts, 4 to 12, which is called swing shift, and 12 to 8, which is called graveyard shift. They rotated every 2 weeks. So you can expect that some of the people you never saw. Some of the men virtually never saw anybody else. During the war, we worked 6 days a week. The seventh day, Sunday, was not a working day. The mine and the mill was shut down most of the time. There were occasions when they did work on Sunday in the mill, and the mine, I mean. Now, during the war, the copper was in short supply, and they had to get it out, and they did work Sundays some of the time. But there is a physical reason why you can't work a mine every day, every hour. They have to blast, and blasting is dynamite. Dynamite leaves fumes. Fumes have to be vented out of the mine. That's a long way in there. So one day of the week was utilized to clear the mine air, in a way. Also, when they blasted, they had a night shift. They ran a day shift and a night shift some of the time, in which that was, I think it was maybe 8 to 4 and then 6 to 2. At the end of that night shift, they blasted, and then the mine had 4 hours to clear out. Approximately 46, I guess, they put in a big ventilator fan across from the ballpark on, I'd say, about the 1,400-foot level, about 100 feet higher than the portal. This fan had a high whine to it, much like the generators that you have sitting up there right now, except a little bit louder. If the wind was blowing just right, it was a little louder. The mill had a noise to it also, but not oppressive. It was simply a dull roar, very dull. I think that we live with far more noise in the cities today than we had up here in this valley. But if the power went off, you knew it. It suddenly became deathly quiet. But it was not oppressive. You never hear it. Last night at what, 2 o'clock, someplace in there, we heard a boom. This reminded me of a powder blast, a large blast underground. It sounded very much like that. If you knew one was coming off, in a way you could hear it, the large one. And sometimes the company would tell us that they were going to put off an exceptionally large blast, and we heard and felt it. But it's one of those things in the mining community. This doesn't happen very often. It's not annoying. It's just interesting to listen for. I just assume at this point now, if people would want to interrupt me to ask questions. The contrast I'm starting with here was that we were here for a purpose. We had a certain level of education. Consequently, the activities that we did were geared to this level of education. Movies 2 nights a week in the rec hall, as we called it, the gymnasium area, covered by a canvas using those metal chairs that are hooked together, which got rolled back on carts underneath that stage. You'll see 4 doors across there. Carts are still there. I just looked today to find out. We used to roll them up when we wanted to do something else. But movies were shown in there. The benches that are in there were up in the balcony all the way around. We also had a very lively bowling league in the winter. Every woman and man in this community that wanted to participate in some sort of a winter activity was in a bowling team. So bowling was the activity during the winter. In the summertime, very, very active baseball, softball primarily. In 1944, I think it was, that the U.S. Army service ball team came up here. Could have been 45. With a Cracker Jack softball team. And they just powdered the dickens out of our best ball players. They had a team came in here with 3 men. And the 3 men played our ball team and beat them hands down. But we didn't have any slouch of a ball team either. The fellas up here were good ball players. They were hard workers, strong men. I can't tell you nationality-wise. Nationality didn't mean anything to me. And I think we had a pretty good cross-section. I don't think we were predominantly any one nationality. I talked this over with Willie. He kept pulling it at me. I do not recall Negroes, Japanese, or Chinese. Of course, Japanese and Germans were out at that time. We used to go out, and that's what we played. The kids played guns, shooting Japanese and Germans out in the woods. But that was the national pastime at the time. And war did not seem to be quite as repulsive as it does today, at least that type of conflict. Of course, it was a different type of conflict than we have today. But I do not remember any racial trends or any nationality trends or language barriers and so forth. I do remember some people, some students from Washington State University, college at the time, coming up here that were from India. And they spoke Indian with their own language. And they were up here for one summer. A group of a half a dozen or so worked here to learn about the workings of the mind. Sort of an exchange student program, I presume. I do recall that. And that's the only thing I recall that might be regarded as racism or anything else which seems to be in vogue today. We didn't have this sort of thing up here because we were here for this one purpose. We were men working together, families working together, pooling together, common interests. We did not have discussion clubs. We did not have meetings like this before. These were not intellectuals. These were not people coming here for a rest, looking for some enlightenment or something like this. These were working men living here for a living. This, I presume, was thought of as hardship by some. But nobody told me it was hardship, so I really didn't know it was. The company here, I think, was probably better to the mining men than any other company has ever been to miners. Today, I suppose the closest analogy to this place would be going to Alaska. Takes just about as long. Takes a full day to get up here. It takes about a day to get to Alaska. But You bet. There was no stopping it. We had a snow plow on the end of a truck. They plowed the road, and then when the road it got too deep to push it aside anymore, they had a rotary snow plow called the Snow Go, the brand name, which was parked down at the dock at Lakeside for some time, and apparently Wes tried to get a hold of it, but through some of the rigmarole legal stuff that he didn't get it. Too bad, because it would have been a very great addition to this place to have that. And they used to go through and plow out with this rotary plow, and it threw it 50 to 100 feet over in the brush and on top of the houses, every place else, in a funnel. They could change direction, too, so they could do both sides of the road and throw it only one side. They used to plow up, eat up the plow pilings and throw it out of the way so they could fill it in again. They used to do this several times a year. So our roads were always kept open. The rotary snow plow, the snow go? Oh, that's interesting.
Yesterday, crawling around up there at the top of the deal where the buildings are, I noticed that electric, the makings of that electric locomotive, and I noticed 48 cells in there and that neatly arranged in the road.
The facilities of the mine, the equipment used at the mine was modern, up to date. At the time it was installed in 1937. It was updated as they went through the 40s as equipment was needed and repaired. But apparently no repairs of any major consequence were made and no replacements were made throughout the life of this 20-year history here. So what you saw up there was a battery-operated emergency trolley or emergency engine that was used to haul the men in and out of the mine in case of power failure. We had a trolley-type engine that was used most of the time. It ran on trolley wires going in the mine. They're probably still in there. I think they had two of those engines that ran in and out, two trains. But, of course, you could only have one track, so only one going one direction at a time. One would be loading. I think they had two engines. I don't know for sure. Occasionally, the battery-powered one was used to haul men, never to haul ore, as far as I know. Sometimes the men were hauled in by the battery-operated unit when there was power still. Men were not generally allowed to walk in the tunnels. It puzzled me. I don't know the answer to this. What happened? The guy got to work late, missed the train. Maybe he walked in. Maybe he didn't work that day. I don't know. The change house, which you go through the basement on the mine tour that we went on this past week, that was the basement. Up above it was where the men changed into their work clothes. They went street clothes. They changed into their work clothes, which were always kept up there. I never saw my father's work clothes. They always carried their lunch and lunch pails, all the men. Worked underground. Then they go in on the train. and they had a little whistle. It was pretty good size. I did not get to hear the fire whistle here. That was the lunch bell time we were here. They had a one on top of the mill. And I, in a way, I was expecting that the fire drill, I could hear it. I was a mile down the valley. I thought that if it were like old times, I'd hear that when it went. I didn't hear it. So I found out it was a lunch bell that blew. But that other whistle, you could hear it. They blew it, I think, a half hour before shift time, so there wasn't any man going to sleep in. He knew that it was time to come to work. And a half an hour is sufficient to get up there. So I think most of the time people were on time. And then the thing blew 5 minutes before the train left, and then they went in the mine. They stayed in there for 8 hours, then they came back out, changed their clothes, or showered, and left the dirty clothes, got in their street clothes, came home, went to bed most of the time, especially when you were on that night shift. My father spent most of the time, since he was drilling, on the night shift rather than the swing graveyard combination. He alternated between days and nights. And so half my life up here, my father was sleeping all day long. The other half, he was working all day long. We didn't get out too much on hikes and things like that, but we did go out occasionally. I've been to all the lakes and all the basins around here. Never climbed a mountain peak, but have been to all the passes. But that's just my personal thing. A lot of the people did climb peaks. Some people even went over as far as Glacier Peak. That was quite a hike. Okay, I do want to talk about the church, because that is one of the big things here today. This is a church center thing here. It's advertised as such. It is drawing the people, as I can tell by the predominance of ministers that are here and the youth groups that come along. And when they announce it, everybody's from Minnesota. I applaud when I hear somebody from California or Oregon or Washington. This is great, these groups that come in here. But you're church-centered, not us. We were mind-centered. We were work-centered. But we did have a church, in a sense. The women, the mothers, would conduct a Sunday school by grades. Grades 1 and 2 in the front corner by the stage, that way by the creek. 3 and 4 on the next one. 4 and 5 back in the corner where the road entrance is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 back in the far corner over toward the tailing stump in the gymnasium floor. I went through most of them. The mothers taught us our religion. This was non-denominational. Also, a minister would come up from Chelan or the vicinity most every Sunday, not every Sunday, but most every Sunday, and conducted an adult religious service, which was held in the center on chairs. This was the extent of our formal religious training, formal religion. As far as Catholicism, Buddhism, Mormonism, any of these that are not Protestant-based, they sort of had to make do. A Catholic priest would come up here once a month in the summertime, once every 3 or 4 months in the wintertime. As I recall, I did not know them. But a good friend of ours were Catholic, so we were aware that priests came up. What they did for the Catholic Mass obligation on Sunday, they seemed to do without. But we did have this, sort of a Sunday school. This is what I remember. This is what we had. So we were church-centered. And most of the children were not required, but pretty heavily suggested that you go to Sunday school. So most of us were there. It was just about like school all over again. Now remember, this is a two-room schoolhouse. Total, in my graduating class in eighth grade here, there were 8 of us. So multiply that by 8, 64. You wouldn't have had more than 100 children of school age. Again, no teenagers. As far as activities are concerned, between the men down here and the men in the family, they were two different things. The men down here didn't have children here. Generally, we're not interested in the same thing that we were. The men down here played pool, played poker, all at a fee, played the slot machines until it became illegal sometime in the early 40s. They put a 25-cent machine in just before they became illegal. I know that was a big thing. But I never got a chance to go down there except to deliver my paper, because it was forbidden for minors, no minors allowed in that section. But I do recall the pool tables exactly as they are now, with the same wires, everything's the same. And the pool, the poker tables in the back where the shaft is right now, and ping pong tables. The barbershop was installed about 1946 or 47 in that room there, I don't know what it was before, and a visiting barber came in here and cut hair certain days of the week, or maybe certain weeks of the month. I don't remember exactly how it worked. But the activities then for these men consisted primarily in that, also reading in their rooms, hiking and things of this nature. The men were fed in the dining hall over here. Men cooks, as I was told today, that they have some pots in there. They're pretty hard for the women to throw around. The men got their lunches made here. They put them on, as I recall, it was a, there were racks where the kids come in on the far side of the dining hall. Now, there were racks in there, and the men put their buckets on this, and while they ate or when they came home from shift, and then when they went back on shift again, the lunch buckets were filled. This was sort of automatic. You forgot to put your pail there, you did without lunch. I ate in the dining hall but once. We went out to dinner one time. So most of the time, we ate at home. The company provided electricity for us, too, and as I recall, of course, I didn't pay the bills, we didn't have to pay for electricity. So when the war was over and electric ranges became available and other appliances, people began to convert to electricity from their wood. They got tired of cooking on wood. And we put in electric water tanks, electric range, electric washing machines. That's something. Some people used the old scrub board. I remember the wringer washer. We had the wringer washer. But then we got I think it was an easy spin dryer was the thing that we got in 1946 or 7. But these were electric powered. The company brought in its power, as the book says here, from Chelan on the wires, some of which are still standing, but the poles are still there. You can see the wires across the lake with those big orange balls on them. Those are the power lines. Twice over here, an airplane took them down. So that is from 46 to 48. They didn't fly planes before that time at the lake. But twice planes hit that. We were out of power one time for, I think, 4 days while they strung the wires across there again. That's quite an undertaking. Occasionally, trees would fall across the power line, we'd be out. But that was very rare because they cleared that power line to at least 100 feet on each side. And you can still see the great swath going down this creek bed where the power line was cut out. So they cut it out. Now, we picked blackcaps in there. Oh, excellent blackcap picking. We shared it with the bears. I recall one time picking blackcaps down about 8 miles, and walking around a bush that was taller than I and probably as big around as this fireplace area. We walked around this. I walked around it face to face to a bear. Needless to say, we both ran as fast as we could in opposite directions. Bears are not vicious around here unless you molest them in some way. Now, we'd also have lots of deer in camp, and people would go hunting. Now, this is a favorite pastime of the men in the campsite, hunting. One vice I never learned. We used to get cigarettes during the war, an interesting sidelight during rationing. We never did without up here. We got our limit on every rationed item because the stores down in Chelan, Safeway and Price, were extremely good to us up here. We couldn't have the first chance to come in and pick it out, but when we sent our weekly order down there, they saw to it, if we forgot to order something, they sent it up to us. And so any rationed item that we forgot to order, and they had it in, they saved it for all their customers here at Holden. So we got our 2 packs of cigarettes every week, which we didn't black market them, but we gave them to our neighbor, who was addicted. And I believe me, 2 packs a week is pretty hard for some people. Well, this came in after I was gone. A snow slide came down the hill up at the upper end of the campsite, went into the went into one fellow's front yard, fortunately didn't do any damage, but cut a swath through the trees, made an excellent ski slope. This happened about 1946. So 47, 48, we had a ski area up on the far corner of the campsite up there. No lift. Apparently a lift was built. According to this book, two were. We didn't have to have ski lifts. We didn't have to have ski grounds, really, because we skied back and forth between here and the upper campsite, or any place. It was pretty good skiing. Snow gets 6 feet deep, nice consistency, a little wet. There were some pretty good skiers up here. We used to ski down these snow slide areas. If you've never been in the mountains during the winter, you probably don't know what it is to see an avalanche or snow slide. But they happen around here all the time. This one at the footbridge came down across here last winter, I guess, right? It was the winter before. You can sure see signs of it. Is that the last one?
January 66.
66, 2 years ago. Two winters, three winters. But you can see it. Well, we had one go down across there in about 46, I think. Really went across, went clear across the creek. But occasionally, they'd always come down part way. We had to watch out. On certain days of the year, when the temperatures were just right, we were forbidden to ski on that area. Good idea, stay across, stay out of the way, and watch it when you cross that area. Look up. We had a man killed on a snow slide coming home from work up where the gravel bunkers are, up on the road up there. A snow slide took out of the normal way of coming down. A little arm of it came down through the trees, went down right alongside of that gravel bunker, picked this man off the upper road, and dragged him down into the gravel bunker. It was about 2 days before they found his body. All the men, the mine I think shut down for that particular event, all the men came out, or else it was just all the off-duty men, came out and immediately started probing that snow slide. They even brought in a dog from Chelan, to a tracking dog, to try to find him. Hopefully that he might be trapped in an ore pocket, a snow pocket, air pocket. Unfortunately, this was not the case. The only casualty that I recall from snow slides, but they were a dangerous hazard that we had to watch out for at certain times of the year.
How about mine?
Mine accidents?
Yes.
The book says something like 28. I didn't recall any mine accidents as far as personnel is concerned, except that when they were backfilling the mine in 1947, 48, the first backfill, as I recall, before they put too much in, the bulkhead failed, and I thought that perhaps somebody was injured in that. I have no substantiation for that. And then later on, after I was gone, the book tells about the one that filled the mine, sort of. At least, put it, one of the bulkheads failed. They backfilled because the mine was unstable. When you take 80 feet out of a rather cracked up rock situation anyway, just like pulling the columns, leaving just a few columns in a big room, pretty soon the roof falls in. If the columns crack or the wall cracks, and it did crack. So they began to have unstable conditions in there, and it was dangerous. So they decided that they had better fill it in. So they started a very expensive thing, I believe, to backfill with the tailings. This was done with water, fluid, and they had a big problem. The bulkheads shown in the picture in this book, one of them. So they filled these stopes, as they call them, and caverns, big rooms. And it was fluid, it wasn't too successful. The company, as I pointed out, didn't allow anybody in here that didn't fit. So if you did anything wrong, you didn't fit, you were exported. Also, the company was very paternalistic. They did everything for the men. We didn't have labor problems. Now, that may have been partly due to this, and partly due to the war effort, and so forth. The company paid competitive wages and provided all of these facilities, best that you could ask for, really. They really helped the men. They gave them the things that they requested, in a way. It may be a little hard to get it. My mother was a good tennis player and wanted to have a tennis court up here. So she worked several years to convince the company to build a tennis court, and they did, finally. They built it up on the tailing stuff. It lasted exactly 1 year. The winter took care of it. It was a bad place to put it. the only flat area around here is the ballpark. Of course, it was being used for other reasons, and so they didn't put it up there. But they did build it, the tennis court. They did try. I don't remember if it was asphalt or concrete. I think it was concrete. The company hauled up our goods, our merchandise, our personal belongings in large quantities once a week on the barge. They had planks or beams or something they put on top of the ore barrels. In fact, I think some of the time they ran the ore concentrates down in two decks. I'm not quite certain of that. They had two barges. One went up, one went down once a week. Two barges, two tugs. Our personal possessions were hauled up if we moved in here on that barge. The groceries were brought up once a week on that barge. And the company then hauled them up from the lake in their trucks and delivered them to us at our houses, just as they replenished their own supplies. So the upper level of the concentrate barges was for supplies. I had the opportunity to ride the tug out of here when we left in 1948. We rented a truck in Spokane. My father drove it up here, and it was loaded on a barge, a rental truck. He drove it up from Lucerne. We packed our personal possessions in it. We had a deadline to meet. The barge went back out again in, I think, 48 hours or less. So we had to load that truck and get it back down there in time to meet the barge going out, about 48 hours with turnaround time. And then we had the truck loaded. I watched the operation with a big crane. By the way, Hal Field, the husband of the teacher, was the crane operator for the entire life of the mine. And he also is in Chelan. So then they unloaded us at Lakeside. Now at this time, I suppose it'd be a good idea to bring in some of the rumors that were talked about 1957, people getting out of here. The company had a policy relative to these houses up here. You could not sell it for more than a certain figure. At the time we moved out, that figure was $2,000.
$2,000 was quite a bit of money in those days. About what, $4,000 now?
At the time the mine shut down, I think the limit was probably in the neighborhood of $3,000. I have no evidence of it. But at any rate, let's just use that for a figure. These people who were up here had no way of selling their houses. They were going to lose, shall we say, $3,000. Okay, so you earn $5,000-$6,000 a year. You lost half a year's earnings that you've had invested in real estate up here that you can't take with you. So what do you do? In 1946, the company, the war effort was over. The company had to look for a new market for its copper. The price of copper was expected to drop. Rumors started around that the company was going to close down. We all knew it was a low-grade operation. 1947, 48, 49, these rumors persisted. 50, 51, 52, 53, the rumors were still around. But people still came in. The company did invest. In 49, they built to allow the people to build these extra things. They repaired. They all the additions that you see on were built in 1948, 49, or most of them, with a few exceptions that differ. Wesley wanted to tell you about how he found this building. It was still a dorm the last time I knew it. And the commissary apparently was done away with, and apparently some other types of stores were brought in here. Our clothing store amounted to either the commissary or the Sears Roebuck catalog. We didn't know what a store was in that sense. We had the fountain lunch down here where we could go and buy ice cream cones and candy bars, things like this. What am I, train of thought here, what was I doing? The closing. So these people, hearing these rumors, in a way didn't believe it. Jack Curzon, the general manager of this place, from 1937 until 1956, I believe, I'm not absolutely certain, but I think it was 56, was one that was very much in favor of the company paternalism. And he saw to it that the company was good to the men. Of course, they had to have their own way, too. And he did not want to, as near as I can figure out from what I've heard, did not want to close this operation down. But the company apparently decided that they would close it down. So in 1956, they brought Mr. Jack Roper in here, changed the manager, changed Mr. Curzon to someplace else. Mr. Curzon shortly left the company and retired and is now living in Chelan. Mr. Roper had, as I understand it, again hearsay, somebody may be able to straighten me out on it, had just closed down another property. He came in here, as near as we can tell, closed this one down. But still people refused to believe it. Some people did get out for one reason or another. We feel fortunate we got out. We got our money out over a course of about 3 years. People paid us on time, as many of the other people have done. So consequently, not only the people who were living here in 1957, but some of those who had left, say, 55, lost out. I do not know of any court suits that were pressed to try to obtain the funds, the balance of such contracts. Maybe there were, I don't know of any. So more people lost than that, but these people wouldn't believe it. I think this is why you might say that somebody walked out of here leaving the dinner plates on the table. I wouldn't be a bit surprised, because they refused to believe it. Now, when the company shut down, take a look at an economic operation. They had these men to work here, some 400 men, at work. It's not economical to run this place with a half staff, a half crew. So they were working, all the men, all the time, right up until the date they said operation ceased this day. Now, they gave some notice. Then the men were put to work dismantling and salvaging to some extent. They didn't do very much salvaging. But they were given, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 months to this operation to get moved. But these men were still working. They were doing various cleanup operations around here. That's why there's, 800,000 tons of ore down that mine still cracked, broken. There's several hundred tons, I'm sure, in the mill sitting there in the hoppers. Everything right in process. This thing stopped and that was it. They may have shipped the last of the ore out down the truck and down the barge and so forth. So these men packed up in their spare time and they moved their personal belongings as much as they could. And the company took everything down to the barge, loaded it on. But when that last barge went out, that was going to be it. There was going to be no more barges up here. And if you didn't have your stuff ready to go, you weren't going to get it out of here. The company hauled it down. And then they dumped it at the dock at Lakeside. Now, that dock's only so big. And you had the responsibility of taking it off that dock. Okay, suppose you didn't have any place to go. Your merchandise was not of particularly great value, like washing machines, things of this nature. 1957, many of these things were easy to pick up secondhand anyhow. Why take them? I mean, what the heck? It's going to cost me more than they're worth to move them. It's, I suppose, the attitude. One family that I know of, and I believe it was two people, actually dismantled their houses and took them out of here. Mm-hmm. And set them up in Chelan or Wenatchee. Mm-hmm. They took everything. But some of the people, apparently refusing to believe this, must have decided to just live here, and then they just walked out and left everything. Some of these people you may never see again. I imagine they harbor something pretty bitter in their hearts. We do not. But we were gone for some time. But now when I think of the people of Holden and how we reacted, I'm thinking of the people up to 1948. Now the environment is different after 1948, partly because of the national environment is different. When did barbecues come in? 1950? Every house around here, the staff houses, I haven't mentioned that. These were houses up here, the chalets, were staff people. General manager, assistant general manager, I think the next one was the chief engineer, and rank up the line around the corner. If you got promoted from an inferior staff position to one that ranked a house, you had to move down here, as my friend, an engineer, did. He had to move from next door to us down here to the staff house. He didn't like it very well, but of course the company said, you're in this position, here's the house that goes with that position. Well, in 1950s, apparently, would be the time they build all these barbecues up around the houses. Every one of them seems to have it. When I get back to Spokane, I'm going to call my friend, find out how come there's that swimming pool, heated swimming pool, no less, up there behind his house. That wasn't there before either. Never heard about that one. I was kind of surprised to see it. The company paved the road from, half a quarter mile down here up to the bridge, through the town. That's the only paved road we had, and it was in excellent shape. bulldozer never ran on. That is, the treaded vehicles never ran on the road. There was a little road above that road. You can still get through it. And up around the circle up there, up behind the houses, there's a road going around. The bulldozer went on that. It didn't run across the main highway. That was for the trucks, company trucks, the concentrate trucks. So today, you have vacation spirit up here. You have teenagers up here. This makes a very definite contrast. You have people up here for 1 week, some people for 1 day, some people for all summer, and a few people for all year. As I see, some of them are going out for a vacation right now. You have lectures. You have intellectuals. You have people of high caliber coming in and talking, speaking about things of controversial issue outside world. We weren't interested in the outside world. We were isolationists, in a way. We had our own self-centered thing. So this wouldn't have been a heck of a lot of interest to us. I don't remember what movies that we saw, probably just like any other run-of-the-mill theater. Some were good, some were bad. All the school activities performed in the gymnasium. I remember giving the speeches at graduation for school, school plays. We put on an operetta every year. Big thing. I think we put it on probably in March or April. It was a real big production number. The whole school participated. All 100 of us. especially the upper grades. We all had parts. Some of the operettas were smaller than others, so just the upper grades did it. I was in most of them, one way or another. Might say also that we had a piano teacher, a part-time teacher, one of the housewives up here.